Anthony Esselin says the following in his book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Western Civilization. Quote, "We all know what the Middle Ages were like. My freshmen know. They've learned it from the infallible authority known as high school platitudes. First, the Middle Ages were dark. People lived in squalor. Beset by terrible fears, they burned kindly old ladies peddling herbal remedies, calling them witches. They made no progress in the natural sciences. They knew nothing of the world beyond their time and place and had no desire to know. Their studies were narrow and dogmatic, and few great minds of their era plied their intellect to discover how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. Life was so miserable that most people, especially the dirt peasant majority, lived only for the next world, placing all their hope in heaven beyond the stars. Let's set the record straight. From 962, the crowning of Otto the Great as Holy Roman Emperor, to 1321, the death of Dante, Europe enjoyed one of the most magnificent flourishings of culture the world has seen. In some ways, it was the most magnificent, and this was not despite the fact that the daily tolling of the church bells provided the rhythm of men's lives, but because of it. Because the people believed they lived in a comic world, that is, a world redeemed from sin, wherein the Savior had triumphed over darkness and death, they could love that world aright. They were pilgrims at heart, who yet passionately loved their native local food and drink. They enjoyed the freedom of hope. They were not pressed to death with urgency to create a heaven upon earth, a longing that ends in despair or the gulag. You won't hear this tale on television or in school. A powerful church should be a regular monster, destroying the intellectual endeavor and enforcing dreariness upon art, long before academia made artistic dreariness a mark of sophistication. Forswearing instant gratification, not that everyone in the Middle Ages did forswear it, should produce a continent of mopes, of seething villains, or something miserable which Americans, with their dropout factories and nearly 3 million incarcerated men, know nothing of. Besides, because we all believe in inevitable social progress, everything must have been terrible in the past, at least comparable to today. We would shy away from the Middle Ages, not because of its drabness, but because its vitality would fray our weak nerves. We'd have to rub our eyes to get used to the light. Why do modern historians classify Christendom as the Dark Ages? Why is this time period obscured by an incantation like a Jedi waving his hand saying, "These are not the droids you're looking for"? Authors of Protestant church history are as much to blame as modern secular historians for attempting to hide, or at least obscuring, this time as a time to be ignored, or at the very least to be ashamed of. There is a sin at root of these narratives and motivations. By condemning this time in our history, these men fundamentally show that they hate their fathers of the faith. They are ashamed of the courage they displayed, of the things they built, and of their failure to measure up to the task of our own time. This modern incantation is an attempt to hide the truth from us. This incantation is reminiscent of the following story told by C.S. Lewis in his book, Silverchair, in which the power of a tyrant can only be maintained by obscuring a world of light, so that men would settle for darkness. In the story, the ruler of the underworld was an evil witch who had enslaved the Prince of Narnia. The prince's faithful companions had freed him from his prison and were making an escape when the witch interrupted their efforts. Now, the witch said nothing at all, but moved gently across the room, always keeping her face and her eyes very steadily towards the prince. When she had come to the little ark set on a wall not far from the fireplace, she opened it and took out first a handful of green powder. This she threw on the fire. It did not blaze much, but a very sweet and drowsy smell came from it. And all through the conversation which followed, the smell grew stronger and filled the room and made it harder to think. Secondly, she took out a musical instrument, rather like a mandolin. She began to play it with her fingers, a steady, monotonous thrumming that you don't notice after a few minutes. But the less you noticed it, the more it got into your brain and your blood. This also made it hard to think. After she had thrummed for a time, and the sweet smell was now growing strong, she began speaking in a sweet, quiet voice. "Narnia," she said, Narnia, I have often heard your lordship utter that name in your ravings. Dear prince, you are very sick. There is no land called Narnia. Yes, there is, though, ma'am, said Puddleglum. You see, I happen to have lived there all my life. Indeed, said the witch. Tell me, I pray you, where that country is. Up there, said Puddleglum, stoutly pointing overhead. I don't know exactly where. How, said the queen with a soft, musical laugh. Is there a country up among the stones and mortar of the roof? No, said Puddleglum, struggling a little to get his breath. It's an overworld. And what, or where, pray, is this, how do you call it, overworld? Oh, don't be so silly, said Scrub, who was fighting hard against the enchantment of the sweet smell and the thrumming. As if you didn't know, it's up above, up where you can see the sky and the sun and the stars. Why, you've been there yourself, we met you there. I cry you mercy, little brother, laughed the witch. You couldn't have heard a lovelier laugh. I have no memory of that meeting, but we often meet our friends in strange places when we dream, and unless all dreamed alike, you must not ask them to remember it. Madame, said the prince sternly, I have already told your grace that I am the king's son of Narnia. And shalt be, dear friend, said the witch in a soothing voice, as if she were humoring a child, shalt be king of many imagined lands in thy fancies. We've been there too, snapped Jill. She was very angry because she could feel the enchantment getting a hold of her every moment. But of course, the very fact that she could still feel it showed it had not yet fully worked. And thou art queen of Narnia too, I doubt not, pretty one, said the witch in the same coaxing, half-mocking tone. I'm nothing of the sort, said Jill, stamping her foot. We come from another world. Why, this is a prettier game than the other, said the witch. Tell us, little maid, where is this other world? What ships and chariots go between it and ours? Of course, a lot of things darted into Jill's head at once. Experiment house, Adelia Pennyfeather, her own home, radio sets, cinemas, cars, aeroplanes, ration books, and queues, but they seemed dim and far away. Thrum, thrum, thrum went the strings of the witch's instrument. Jill couldn't remember the names of the things in our world. And at this time, it didn't come into her head that she was being enchanted. For now, the magic was in its full strength. And of course, the more enchanted you get, the more certain you feel that you are not enchanted at all. She found herself saying, and at the moment, it was a relief to say, No, I suppose that other world must all be a dream. Yes, it is a dream, said the witch, always thrumming. Yes, all a dream, said Jill. There never was such a world, said the witch. No, said Jill and Scrub, never was such a world. There never was any world but mine, said the witch. There never was any world but yours, said they. Puddleglum was still fighting hard. I don't know rightly what you all mean by a world, he said, talking like a man who hasn't enough air. But you can play the fiddle till your fingers drop off, and still you won't make me forget Narnia and the whole overworld too. We'll never see it again, I shouldn't wonder. You may have blotted it out and turned it dark like this, for all I know. Nothing more likely, but I know I was there once. I've seen the sky full of stars. I've seen the sun coming up out of the sea of a morning and sinking behind the mountains at night. And I've seen him up in the midday sky when I couldn't look at him for brightness. Puddleglum's words had a very rousing effect. The other three all breathed again and looked at one another like people newly awakened. Why, there it is, cried the prince. Of course, the blessing of Aslan upon this honest marsh wiggle. We all have been dreaming these last few minutes. How could we have forgotten it? Of course, we've all seen the sun. By Jove, so we have, said Scrub. Good for you, Puddleglum. You're the only one of us with any sense, I do believe. Then came the witch's voice, cooing softly like the voice of a wood pigeon from the high elms of an old garden at 3 o'clock in the middle of a sleepy summer afternoon, and it said, What is this sun you all speak of? Do you mean anything by the word? Yes, we jolly well do, said Scrub. Can you tell me what it's like? Asked the witch. Thrum, thrum, thrum went the strings. Please it, your grace, said the prince very coolly and politely. You see that lamp? It is round and yellow, and gives light to the whole room, and hangeth moreover from the roof. Now that thing which we call the sun is like the lamp, only far greater and brighter. It giveth light to the whole overworld, and hangeth in the sky. Hangeth from what, my lord? Asked the witch. And then while they were still all thinking how to answer her, she added, with another of her soft silver laughs, You see, when you try to think out clearly what the sun must be, you cannot tell me. You can only tell me it is like the lamp. Your sun is a dream, and there is nothing in that dream that was not copied from the lamp. The lamp is the real thing. The sun is but a tale, a children's story. Yes, I see now, said Jill in a heavy, hopeless tone. It must be so. And while she said this, it seemed to her to be very good sense. Slowly and gravely, the witch repeated, There is no sun. And they all said nothing. She repeated in a softer and deeper voice, There is no sun. After a pause and after a struggle in their minds, all four of them said together, You're right, there is no sun. It was such a relief to give it and say it. There never was a sun, said the witch. No, there never was a sun, said the prince and the marsh wiggle and the children. For the last few minutes, Jill had been feeling that there was something she must remember at all costs, and now she did, but it was dreadfully hard to say it. She felt as if huge weights were laid on her lips. At last, with an effort that seemed to take all of the good out of her, she said, There's Aslan. Aslan, said the witch, quickening ever so slightly the pace of her thrumming. What a pretty name. What does it mean? He is the great lion who called us out of our own world, said Scrub, and sent us into this to find Prince Rillian. What is a lion? Asked the witch. Oh, hang it all, said Scrub. Don't you know? How can we describe it to her? Have you ever seen a cat? Surely, said the queen. I love cats. Well, a lion is a little bit, only a little bit, mind you, like a huge cat, with a mane, at least. It's not like a horse's mane, you know. It's more like a judge's wig, and it's yellow and terrifically strong. The witch shook her head. I see, she said, that we should do no better with your lion, as you call it, than we did with your sun. You have seen lamps, and so you imagined a bigger and better lamp, and call it the sun. You've seen cats, and now you want a bigger and better cat, and it's to be called a lion. Well, 'tis a pretty make-believe thought to say truth. It would suit you all better if you were younger. And look how you can put nothing into your make-believe without copying it from the real world, this world of mine, which is the only world. But even you children are too old for such play. As for you, my lord prince, that art a man fully grown, fie upon you. Are you not ashamed of such toys? Come, all of you, put away these childish tricks. I have work for you all in the real world. There is no Narnia, no overworld, no sky, no sun, no Aslan. And now to bed all, and let us begin a wiser life tomorrow. But first to bed, to sleep, deep sleep, soft pillows, sleep without foolish dreams. The prince and the two children were standing with their heads hung down, their cheeks flushed, their eyes half closed, the strength all gone from them, the enchantment almost complete. But Puddleglum, desperately gathered all his strength, walked over to the fire. Then he did a very brave thing. He knew it wouldn't hurt him quite as much as it would hurt a human, for his feet, which were bare, were webbed and hard and cold-blooded like a duck's. But he knew it would hurt him badly enough, and so it did. With his bare foot, he stamped on the fire, grinding a large part of it into ashes on the flat hearth. And three things happened at once. First, the sweet, heavy smell grew very much less. For though the whole fire had not been put out, a good bit of it had. And what remained smelled very largely of burnt marsh wiggle, which is not at all an enchanting smell. This instantly made everyone's brain far clearer. The prince and the children held up their heads again and opened their eyes. Secondly, the witch, in a loud, terrible voice, uttered different from all the sweet tones she had been using up till now, called out, What are you doing? Dare to touch my fire again, mud filth, and I'll turn your blood to fire inside your veins. Thirdly, the pain itself made Puddleglum's head for a moment perfectly clear, and he knew exactly what he really thought. There is nothing like a good shock of pain for dissolving certain kinds of magic. "One word, ma'am," he said, coming back from the fire, limping because of the pain. "One word. All you've been saying is quite right, I shouldn't wonder. I'm a chap who always liked to know the worst and then put a best face on it I can. So I won't deny any of what you've said. But there's one thing more to be said, even so. Suppose we have only dreamed or made up all those things, trees and grass and sun and moon and stars and Aslan himself. Suppose we have. Then all I can say is that, in that case, the made-up things seem a good deal more important than the real ones. Suppose this black pit of a kingdom of yours is the only world. Well, it strikes me as a pretty poor one. And that's a funny thing when you come to think of it. We're just babies making up a game, if you're right. But four babies playing a game can make a play world which licks your real world hollow. That's why I'm going to stand by the play world. I'm on Aslan's side, even if there isn't any Aslan to lead it. I'm going to live as like a Narnian as I can, even if there isn't any Narnia. So thanking you kindly for our supper, if these two gentlemen and the young lady are ready, we're leaving your court at once and setting out in the dark to spend our lives looking for Overland. Not that our lives will be very long, I should think, but that's a small loss if the world's as dull a place as you say." "Oh, hooray, good old Puddleglum," cried Scrub and Jill. But the prince shouted suddenly, "Where? Look to the witch!" When they did look, their hair nearly stood on end. The instrument dropped from her hands. Her arms appeared to be fastened to her sides. Her legs were intertwined with each other, and her feet had disappeared. The long green train of her skirt thickened and grew solid, and seemed to be all one piece with the writhing green pillar of her interlocked legs. And that writhing green pillar was curving and swaying as if it had no joints, or else were all joints. Her head was thrown far back, and while her nose grew longer and longer, every part of her face seemed to disappear except her eyes. Huge, flaming eyes they were now, without brows or lashes. All this takes time to write down. It happened so quickly that there was only just time to see it. Long before there was time to do anything, the change was complete, and the great serpent, which the witch had become, green as poison, thick as Jill's waist, had flung two or three coils of its loathsome body round the prince's legs. Quick as lightning, another great loop darted around, intending to pinion his sword arm to his side. But the prince was just in time. He raised his arms and got them clear. The living knot closed only round his chest, ready to crack his ribs like firewood when it drew tight. The prince caught the creature's neck in his left hand, trying to squeeze it till it choked. This held its face, if you could call it a face, about 5 inches from his own. The forked tongue flickered horribly in and out, but could not reach him. With his right hand, he drew back his sword for the strongest blow he could give. Meanwhile, Scrub and Puddleglum had drawn their weapons and rushed to his aid. All three blows fell at once. Scrub's, which did not even pierce the scales and did no good, on the body of the snake below the prince's hand. But the prince's own blow and Puddleglum's both on its neck. Even that did not quite kill it, though it began to loosen its hold on Rillian's legs and chest. With repeated blows, they hacked off its head. The horrible thing went on coiling and moving like a bit of wire long after it had died, and the floor, as you might imagine, was a nasty mess. What if the Dark Ages were not dark? What if they want you to believe, like an incantation, that the Dark Ages were actually a time of light, a time of human flourishing, a time of global dominion of the Lord Jesus Christ? What if the beauty of the cathedrals that were built were not a sign of an oppressive Christian empire, but were the work of men who feared God and loved the light of Jesus Christ? What if their work was a testament to the works of God and His glory, and not merely the works of a dark and evil people living in evil times? In the 12th century, the Abbot Sugar engraved the following on the doors of the Abbey Church of St. Denis. "All you who seek to honor these doors, marvel not at the gold and expense, but at the craftsmanship of the work. The noble work is bright, but being nobly bright, the work should brighten the minds, allowing them to travel through the lights, to the true light, where Christ is the true door. The golden door defines how it is imminent in all these things. The dull mind rises to the truth through material things and is resurrected from its former submersion when the light is seen." The King's Hall podcast exists to make self-ruled men who rule well and win the world.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to this episode of the King's Hall podcast. We have really some podcast champions joining us.
Man, so true, King.
First and foremost, Puddle Glum himself. Dan Burkholder.
Whoa.
That's a high compliment.
Hey, I'm not a podcast champion. There's only one podcast champion that's being recorded right now. There are two in the room, but it's Brian Sauvé.
Man, I just want to say, first of all, I'd like to thank the Lord for granting me such talent.
Oh, my word.
I'm just kidding, guys. We're all champions. You know who the real champion is? Ogden.
Why are you gay?
You know what?
That guy deserved. That was deserved. Ben Zaslav said that guy, he put him in the meme. He was a winner. So, for people who don't know,
Come on.
If you were living under a rock, what happened, Brian? Just walk me through the.
So there was a podcast competition of a poll competition on Twitter.com that put 64 supposedly reformed podcasts head to head and did an elimination style bracket where, you know, it was down to the final two. And look, not only did King's Hall and Haunted Cosmos make the top 64. Not only did we make the top 32, not only did we make the top 16, not only did we make the top 8, and not only did we make the top 4, but Ogden vanquished, and we tied for first place as far as I'm concerned with a double Ogden win. Thank you guys for voting. All you Anons, you know who you are.
You know who you are.
So,
you
know, we don't.
Nobody
actually,
else does.
We don't know who you are in every case.
We do not know. We gave away some tickets, Brian.
Yeah, we did.
To a conference. I think it's worth pointing out, too, that the round that really caught my attention was Apologia.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was the final four. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we had Dividing Line against Haunted Cosmos on one side. And then we had Apologia, Jeff Durbin, you know, on the other side against King's Hall. And they've got, I mean, probably tens of millions of. So James White's YouTube channel has 23 million plus views so far. Apologia has millions and millions. They've got way more followers than us, way more all everything. And you guys showed up and you said no.
I think we probably would have lost even on the Dividing Line Haunted Cosmos.
Then the Winged Hussars arrived.
Then the Winged Hussars arrived.
The Winged Anons.
The Winged Anons arrived.
I think we would have lost to James White, but everybody was trying to cast a vote via ham radio.
They were like, how do I get it to bounce off the ionosphere? Where's Twitter?
And so it just didn't work for them.
I'm just glad the poll wasn't on Facebook.
Seriously.
Because the Boomer Army would have come out.
We would have lost. Oh, yeah. We would have lost for sure. But yeah, that was, you know what? I love the mandate because it just said that what you guys love is applied theology. Theology that makes contact with your life. And you love gay jokes.
Well, do you remember when George W. Bush, he won the hanging chad election with Al Gore. And he said afterwards, he's like, I now have a mandate. And it was like, I have a mandate to do whatever I want. And so I'm kind of taking that to heart.
Yeah, that's kind of how
we
I feel.
We actually have a mandate now.
We beat Apologia by a total of 90 something votes out of 6,000? Yes. Do we have a mandate? Yes. Obviously, yes.
Obviously, yes. Yes. As I said, we gave away a bunch of conference tickets. That was really Dan's idea. And part of that is, Brian, we have this enormous conference coming.
We do.
And so if you would tell our dear listeners what they're going to miss out on if they don't join us.
Look, June 6th to the 8th, Ogden, Utah. That's a Thursday evening through a Saturday afternoon. We have one of the coolest buildings in Ogden booked. More than 1,000 seats available to us. And we are going to be talking about building Christian boroughs, building thick Christian culture with Dr. Stephen Wolfe, Dr. Rigney, who you're going to hear more from later in this episode. Obviously the Ogden folks and more. So come hang out. We got a singles mixer that's going on. I'll be doing a live concert and then stay through Sunday because we're going to probably book the same room and just do our church service so we can fit everybody at the venue as well.
Since we can't even fit our normal people in our own church.
Yeah. We were 99% full on Sunday. So probably more like 106% full, to be honest.
Yeah. With the littles.
Yeah. With the little people.
Yeah. So, a good turnout so far. I think you said we have over 500 people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who are coming to the conference. We've got 70 people coming to a singles mixer.
Yep.
We're projecting at least 10 weddings to come out of this event.
10 to 20, probably. I think conservatively.
10 to 20.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and we're going to be singing psalms together. I'll be sending out
You've
a playlist.
Got a conference, or a concert.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Conference,
I'll be doing a live concert of some of my original music and psalm settings, but also I'll be sending out in about a month or so, maybe 6 weeks out from the concert, from the conference, the psalms that we'll be singing together, so you can start working on your parts and sea shanty, and we're just going to have a lot of fun. It's going to be so much fun.
How jazzed are you, Dan?
I mean, my face is it all right now.
Yeah.
I wish
yeah.
people could see. Dan's actually making jazz hands right now.
Yeah, I am. Getting Watch. Yeah.
Soaked.
Dan just did a cartwheel across the podcasting table. It's the noise gates on these mics are so good you couldn't hear it, but it happened.
That's what it was. We are, gentlemen, jumping into this episode in just a minute. We've got a fantastic conversation with Dr. Joe Rigney. Of course, we'll be one of the speakers at the event. But Dan and I got a chance to sit down with him. One of the things that sticks out in this episode, it's why we chose the cold open the way that we did, his reference to Puddleglum, a really interesting character. You know, we're asking who your favorite characters are in Narnia, and he pointed to Puddleglum. And it's interesting because we've said that there's sort of a disenchantment going on with the way history is told about the West, and it's made to dishearten people. But it was interesting, Dan, that he pointed out, actually, there's a dark spell over the West.
Yeah, there is an enchantment.
Yeah. So walk me through what you see as the significance. Obviously, he'll talk about it in the episode, too. We're adding here some of our, we're zhuzhing it up.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you just look at recent history, if there's any part of data or information or history that the predominant narrative in our society is trying to obscure, it's immediately where you ought to dig, right? Yeah. That's just kind of the instincts that we've been developing. And why are you looking at
so
me
true?
Like
that's such a profound point.
And so, I mean, this really was a crux for this whole season is that, you know, you look at the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages, there's a lot of mystery around this time period. It's over 1,000 years of our own history.
Yep.
And we knew almost nothing about it other than what the predominant narrative told us. And so as we started to dig in, you realize there's a reason, I think, that historians, secular and Protestant, don't want us to look in this time period, that there is actually an enchantment. Like I said, in the cold open, these aren't the droids you're looking for. Like just trying to avert your eyes from this time period. And I think there are many reasons for it, but I'd be curious to hear what you guys have to say about, like, what are the motivations?
Yeah, I totally agree. I want to get a little background on Puddleglum. So for people who don't know.
Dan's question was great, but I'm going to ask a better one.
It was phenomenal. But I do want to ask about Puddleglum before we get on to that. So, Brian, as the sort of, I guess, Narnian in the room, are you
I will never forget that you said that. And it will now be my whole personality. Thank you. I want to say thank you.
So who's Puddleglum? Why does this matter in this conversation?
Puddleglum is a marshwiggle, and he shows up in the silver chair. In the silver chair, he accompanies the children that Aslan sends into Narnia, as he does in the stories, to save Narnia from some great peril. And they're sent to save King or Prince Rillian from this sorceress who has, in a snake-like form, the Lady of the Green Kirtle. She has kidnapped him, killed his mother, and is imprisoning him so that she can magically enslave him and dig a big tunnel up into Narnia and come up and conquer all of Narnia and rule through through Rillian like a puppet, right? But he's enchanted. He's insane under her magic spell. And Puddleglum is just this character who is comically pessimistic. He feeds the kids a meal and he says, well, we've got a meal for you, but it probably won't agree with you. You'll probably be sick for days and it'll be sunny and he'll be like, well, you know, it's probably a thunderclap coming in the net. You know, he's always pessimistic. But then at the end of the story, and you've had like 70 years to read it, guys, so calm down.
And I read the portion
and he literally read it. You see that whole exchange where Puddleglum stands stalwart as this kind of like gloomy, principled, just immovable, courageous figure. He's one of the, I think, one of the top five characters in the Narniad.
Why, Dan, I know you agreed with Dr. Rigney, maybe one of the great characters. Why?
Well, This may not come as a surprise.
Obviously, you resonate with him.
I resonate with the character of Bob Glum. Why?
Why, Dan?
I don't know. Maybe it's my chipper disposition.
I've always seen you as more of a Reepicheep. No, actually, I've always seen Eric.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I could be bestowed a higher honor. I think I need to say no more.
No more. Stop.
No, one of the things that's really interesting about Puddle Glum is I think we can all relate to him to a degree. Maybe not. Maybe it is just my disposition. But when the moment comes, the moment for courage comes, he actually does the hard thing.
Yeah.
And we've talked about this for seasons. Like, you're going to be faced with a decision one day, whether it's small or great, where you actually have to step on the fire and you have to do the courageous thing. And so he does the thing, but not only that, the motivation for why he stamps out the fire and he breaks this incantation is because of faith, because of his faith in Aslan and his faith in the world that Aslan created. And so part of our whole goal with this episode in particular, like, why aren't we just diving into the Crusades, is because I contend that there is an enchantment over our time in trying to hide our past and in trying to disrespect our fathers that came before us. Because if we actually have faith in the work that the Lord Jesus Christ has done in the narrative of history, I think it would stir courage in the hearts of men. And I don't think that people want that. I don't think the enemies of God want that.
Amen.
And so that's why I really resonate with the Marsh Wiggle.
Yeah. I love how you just put it, that we're all going to have moments in our lives where we need to stamp our foot in the fire of that dark enchantment and fill the air with the aroma of burnt marsh wiggle, which is an offensive aroma. Like, it's in a, people don't like the point being, people don't like it when you stomp on the fire of enchantment.
You're making
They'll
a
call
stink.
You an enemy. Yeah. You're making a stink. You're filling the room with burnt marsh wiggle, but we must nonetheless put our foot in that fire. Otherwise, the enchantment will never be broken.
Eric always smells.
Eric always smells a burnt marsh wiggle.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. I'd like
thank
to
thank you. I want to accept that. one of the questions I want to ask, since we have a resident scholar from the haunted cosmos in Pastor Brian Sauve.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Ben.
But also Ben's here, so he can grab a mic and chime in. Is it weird that people would say this is demonic? There's more to it than just the material. I don't know if you would say that this enchantment is, but we know the world is just stuff, Brian. So how could it be more than that?
Well,
are there spiritual powers? What's going on?
Yeah. Well, we know that this entire war is fundamentally a war that's not with flesh and blood at the bottom, but that it's with powers and principalities in the heavenly places. And they obviously fight on the stage of the material. But what we've seen, part of the dark enchantment of since the Enlightenment, has been the reduction and reduction and reduction, more and more, one step at a time, from cosmic origins to human origins to intellectual origins to philosophical truth, all of these different steps down the ladder, till we got to brute materialism, where people are positing that the world is just stuff. That everything that is material.
And the world is not just stuff.
And I'm telling you. But what's crazy about this whole process of deracination, where we've cut ourselves off from the root of the spiritual, is that it's so dumb and untenable, because the world really is not just stuff, that eventually it stops working. And you find that just under, when you scratch the surface of materialism, all of the old gods are there right under the surface. Mm. All of the old demons, they turn out to be the ones through human wickedness, certainly, and human unbelief and human hardness of heart. They've been propping up and orchestrating an assault and a war against the kingdom of God via these materialist follies, right? Oh, there's no sun above. There's no overworld. There's no Aslan. What a silly, you've just gotten your idea of the sun from this lamp. Like, they've been pulling that crap. It's so stupid. It's completely nonsensical when you think about it at the end of the day, all of their materialist claims. But as that withdraws, the high tide of that has already happened. As the tide pulls back and the wave pulls back, what it's going to leave and what people are going to turn to are supernatural, spiritual, overt spiritual forces of darkness. And you'll find that the same forces orchestrating that materialist play are the demons and the old gods that are going to continue to enslave people via paganism and witchcraft and all of these other evil, overtly demonic practices wearing lots of different faces. So I think it's important to see that one of the ways that they have to, one of the areas they have to succeed, if they're going to, the demons are going to succeed in this battle in their servants, is they cannot allow for the glory of Christian history to shine through. They can't allow for that because that is the story of the advance of the kingdom of God, putting down all of those old gods. If we apostatize, they will come back. In fact, they'll bring seven of their friends worse than themselves. Yeah. But that's the story.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. So I saw it yesterday on Twitter, but there was a video with James O'Keefe and Eric Metaxas. So James from Project Veritas was talking about, you know, getting ousted from Project Veritas and going up against the powers that be, Planned Parenthood, stuff like this, like really demonically backed people and forces. And he had an interesting thing, and this gets to putting your foot in the fire. You know, Eric was asking him about, like, how is this to speak truth to power and all that stuff? And he said, you have to settle in yourself that your price can't be 10 million. It can't be 20. It can't be 200 million. The price has to be your life. He said, and when you realize that you're going to have to put your life on the line, he said, trust me, things get spiritual real quick.
Yeah.
And so I think that's one of the realities in a materialist, quote unquote, world.
Yep.
That you're finding out, like, no, there's actually more going on here. And you see that when you go to battle. And we've certainly seen that when you go to battle with some of these ideas. One of them, Brian, you mentioned the Enlightenment. One of the ideas that we'll unpack, especially as we get into next episode in the First Crusade, is the Enlightenment idea that there were a thing called the Dark Ages. So, Dan, I'm going to ask you about that in just a second, but I want to reread this quote from, I think, Anthony Esselin. He said, we would shy away from the Middle Ages, not because of its drabness, but because its vitality would fray our weak nerves. We'd have to rub our eyes to get used to the light.
Dang.
So Esselin for the win, obviously. But Dan, I want to ask you about that. This is one of the big lies, is that this great period of Christendom was actually dark. And so I want to ask you just to unpack that for me. Why is that so important that we get that right?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting question and a really good quote, if I do say so myself. The term Dark Ages, I was really curious as to its origins. It actually appeared in the 14th century. It was Petrarch. He said this: amidst the errors there shone forth men of genius, no less keen were their eyes, although they were surrounded by darkness and dense gloom. So this term, the Dark Ages, originally meant that the world of Christendom was light and it was surrounded by darkness.
Interesting.
Because they were being attacked by the pagan hordes.
Yeah.
Remember the Mohammedans?
The Mohammedans.
Yeah, they were being attacked by them. What's really interesting is that through the Reformation, the Protestants actually latched on this idea that originated in the Renaissance, that it was actually a dark age. And they added anti-Catholic perspectives, saying that the light of the gospel was lost during that time or it was diminished.
Wait, so you're saying that the Protestant reformers were saying, yeah, it was dark because it was Catholic.
It was dark because it was Catholic. And they contrasted it with the classical antiquity period as being rich in Latin, and it witnessed the beginnings of the Christian faith. And so they promoted the ideas that the Middle Age was this time of darkness because of corruption.
Interesting.
Within the Catholic Church, because there was the papacy. There was obviously like some serious problems.
Yeah, there was some
licentious priesthood. Like, and
it's funny because sometimes we think, oh, yeah, that was true of back then. But we forget that if you just look at what's happening in Christendom today.
Yeah, you can look. Look at the Vatican or at the local mega church.
Yeah, right. You're going to find nonsense.
You're
going to
find corruption. And so I think that's really the origin of the idea of the Dark Ages. It was proposed as this idea that Christianity was a light in a very, very dark time. And you can see how that's actually flipped to say, no, the darkness was actually Christianity and the oppression.
That's really interesting. Brian, I'm curious from your perspective, why do you think? Why have Christians not done more to attack this idea of dark ages, materialism, enlightenment thinking? I know some people obviously have.
Yeah.
But it didn't catch on in the mainstream. I'm curious, did they think it wasn't a threat?
I think what happened, there's probably lots of correct answers. But I think that one of the things that certainly happened is that the enemy, this rationalist enlightenment thinking, liberalism, we call today the libs, very sophisticatedly, they are masters of turning your weapons against you And so what they did this with the Crusades. I think they did this with the medieval period. They did it with lots of different aspects of Christianity, is that they would take some of the ethical framework of Christians, and then they would find problems and sins, and then they would say, aren't you ashamed of these people? Look, they didn't even follow your book, right? Look, though, they killed some people unjustly. Look, they were greedy. This person was sexually licentious. And over time, what they did is they averted our gaze to settle entirely on the faults of our forefathers until we forgot their glories. And until we, and also they did that without the introspection of looking in the mirror of our own lives and time and recognizing that every age has its evils. Every age has its follies. But the Christian gospel was weaponized against us, similarly to people who say, like, hey, yeah, just let the illegal immigrants come in and take your country and that. Because turn the other cheek, guys.
Yeah. Or get the vax or wear the mask. Don't you love your neighbor?
Same play. It's just played out in slow motion until our gaze was filled with their sins. And then we began to invent new sins and do this midrash where we went back through their history and imported novel sins we'd made up onto them. And so pretty soon it's like all of the DEI sins, we're finding them in Luther and we're finding them in Calvin and we're finding them in Augustine or finding them in like all these. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Using chronological snobbery in order to export the sins of today on our ancestors who lived in a different time.
And we didn't take the time or care to actually understand them. That's why you look at a man like Lewis, and one of the glories of Lewis, people call him the last medieval man, because he sought to understand them. And I think he succeeded. He had a very, like, he could think their thoughts after them, understand where they were coming from. He could value the things they valued. And even though I don't think Lewis agreed with everything they did, obviously he didn't, but he sought to understand them. Because that's, if you love somebody, you'll seek to understand them charitably. The enemy doesn't want us to do that with our forefathers. It wants us to be uncharitable and ungrateful. Fundamentally, because to do that is ultimately just practice for being ungrateful towards our Father in heaven and accusing him of sin.
That's really helpful. One final question, and then we'll jump into this wonderful interview with Dr. Rigney. But a lot of people would say, I think particularly if you're like a political right wing type person, but especially not a Christian or haven't really thought through a lot of the things we've unpacked in this show, they would probably say to something like this, this is stupid. You guys are talking about Narnia and C.S. Lewis in fiction. Fiction is stupid and fiction doesn't matter. We need to change the political structure. So the look on Brian's face, I wish we had video for that look. But Dan, I want to kick this to you because you're a big story guy. You're a big story guy. Uh-huh. We have seen, even today as we were talking through this episode, Dan's reading to me from The Silver Chair. I mean, my eyes were getting moist just thinking about it.
Yeah.
It moves you. It makes you want to go put your feet in the fire. But Dan, why story when there's so many practical political things we could be doing?
Let me answer the question and then throw it over to you. No, to the person who would say that stories are dumb, that C.S. Lewis, The Chronicles of Narnia, this is childish. There's a really good quote from Robert Howard, and it goes like this. Civilized men are more discourteous than savages because they know they can be impolite without having their skulls split as a general thing.
The Viking hath spoken.
No, but in all honesty, what you said is right. Is the fundamentals of story is it actually sneaks past the defenses of your intellectualism and of your day. And it tends to sneak down past your mind and right into your heart. And so Puddle Glum can accomplish more in that story over the last 60 years or whenever it was published than the best defense of, you know, courage from an intellectual viewpoint. Because I can look at Puddle Glum and say, you know, Puddle Glum's my guy. I want to be like Puddle Glum. And I can say that to Brian, and Brian has read the story, and Eric hasn't, but he will. And Ben has. And I can say, hey, man, today be Puddle Glum.
Yeah.
And we all know immediately in our heart that it rings with courage.
Yeah.
So that's why story is so important, because it gets past those defenses and right into your heart.
Did you guys know that I'm going to be turning 40 this year?
What?
What?
Yeah, looking back, one of my biggest regrets is that I didn't know the basics of investing. That whole world was foreign to me. and I didn't know where to go to get help. The thing is, I missed decades of opportunities to build inheritances for my kids and to take care of my wife and me in retirement.
You know what, Dan? I'm in somewhat of the same spot, except I still have all my hair. My eyes glaze when people talk about IRAs, life insurance, and tax strategies. But not only that, Dan, I don't have time to sit at my desk, study stock market charts, and read tax codes.
You guys may be older than me, but it's not too late, even at your geriatric age, to get help. Joe Garrisey with Backwards Planning Financial is helping all of us with our financial planning. He is a Christian man who works with one of the largest and most trusted financial service companies in the world.
You know, that's part of why I regret not doing this earlier. Joe helped me to see the opportunities I missed, and he developed a plan for my family based on my goals. Joe has made himself available at all hours of the day to help me.
Whether you have millions in assets or just starting to invest, Joe Garrisey will help you reach your goals to grow the kingdom and leave a good legacy for your generations.
Visit backwardsplanningfinancial.com. That's backwardsplanningfinancial.com or call 615-767-2555 to speak with Joe to prepare for the future.
Here at the Hard Men Podcast, you know I'm a huge supporter of men who value hard-nosed hard work. Our country is literally built on the backs of men who have carried the weight of responsibility for their families and driven the economy forward. That's why I'm so excited to join forces with Max D. Trailers, a Texas-based and family-owned company, to bring you this episode. I'm proud to partner with Max D. to see the vision of New Christendom established one small business at a time. Max D builds innovative, hardworking trailers for the builders, fixers, and growers of the world. The company proudly supports blue-collar haulers, men whose businesses depend on Max D Trailers. You can follow their stories by checking out Max D Trailers on Instagram or by visiting the link in the show notes. Learn more about Max D Trailers by visiting maxdtrailers.com, where you can check out the article, 10 Ways to Make Money with Your Trailer.
Yeah, but Brian, facts don't care about your feelings. So oh boy. I want to hear Brian's answer. Because once again, I think this has been the conservative movement. We talked about it, but it's like we need another white paper. We need another argument. A lot of those people aren't doing anything. Why story? Why Narnia? Joe's obviously this great mind on Narnia. But why spend your time reading it?
Yeah, I mean, stories encode truth or lies powerfully and in ways, like Dan said, that teach you truth in a way that's deeper than the mere statement of a proposition, a true proposition, or an argument that is both a deductive argument that is both valid and sound, right? You can take truth and you can encode it in story in a way that actually tends to function the way that the Lord works in his telling of truth, which is that you think about it, like when God created the world, which is full of truth, his word is truth. He what does he do? Well, he wraps it all in beauty and majesty and glory and mysteries and wonders. And then he uses it, he creates time and he uses it to create a great story that he tells through history. And most of that story we'll never read. Like, Andy Wilson has talked about this before, like this, we'll never know the story of the last stand of a valiant ant, carpenter ant, who saved his colony at the gift of his life from the invading wasps. That story's playing out a billion times daily on this planet. And the mother deer that gives her life to, you know, save from the wolves.
Because Dan shot the deer,
but he did not shoot the deputy. No, I think that you look at, how does God tell the truth? How does God? Well, he wraps it in beauty and glory and mystery and majesty. And it's not all just, Jesus didn't come and give us a systematic theology. No, he came as the truth incarnate and he lived a life. So it doesn't mean those things. We're actually not pitting those two things against one another. You ought to have systematic theology. However, one of the errors, and the reason I think we've lost, one of the reasons we've lost so much ground, is because conservatives have, they have cared not enough about story and beauty, And they've let the enemies take those weapons that are force multipliers on truth or error. And they've let them use them to force multiply their errors. While we have told, by the way, first of all, before I say this, we've told the best stories. There's a reason Lord of the Rings, I think, is the greatest work of fiction in the English language. And that's a Christian story, right? So before I denigrate, we've told some of the best stories of all time, but we've also told by volume a lot of really sloppy and lazy stories that are thinly veiled packaging for propositions in ways that doesn't actually win people's hearts.
It's clunky.
It's embarrassing.
But what's not clunky and embarrassing
is this transition.
So we're going to jump into the interview. But first, I do want to give a plug for another great story.
Yeah.
So if you join on Patreon, you'll have full access to these. Most recent story we've been telling is of Sir Godfrey of Bouillon.
Yeah.
And let me just say that if you cut a man in half with your sword in one stroke and half of his body rides back into town and disheartens all the other Mohammedans, then that's a good story, Dan.
Sounds like a great
story. That would be a really good story.
A great story. And then you become sort of the king of Jerusalem, even though he doesn't want to take that title.
Wait, and where can I hear that story?
That's on the Deus Vault.
Okay.
And that is on Patreon. So we encourage people to sign up for the King's Hall Patreon.
That sounds like the kind of thing that allows us to keep doing this important work at
really
a high
does.
Level.
It does,
Eric,
Ryan.
And just show their thankfulness for this content. Man, that's
great.
Yeah, if
you
want to
see more
that,
of
Eric.
It, yeah, exactly. Invest your dollars in the things you want to see more of. Stories are winning. That was the big encouragement to me the podcast bracket is that I think story and the format is resonating. And we've been blessed by that, and we hope you have been too.
Yeah.
So, gentlemen, until next time, we'll part ways here. But, listener, enjoy this interview with Dr. Joe Rigney. Well, welcome to this episode of the King's Hall podcast. Today, we have a special guest, Mr. Joe Rigney. Joe, thanks so much for joining us for this episode of the King's Hall podcast.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Joe, we wanted to start off talking a little bit about fatherhood. So we're dealing with that in season two of the King's Hall podcast, just kind of to get some of the background on you for people who don't know kind of your background, where you've been, you're teaching now at New St. Andrews, but just fill us in on kind of who you are as a person.
Sure. I grew up in West Texas in a town called Midland. Claim to fame is Friday Night Lights. So I did that in high school. Also, George Bush lived there for a while, George W. So there's that. And so yeah, grew up there, then went to Texas A&M. University. It's where I met my wife. And then we moved to Minnesota right when we were married. And I was a part of the Bethlehem Institute. It's now Bethlehem College and Seminary. So it was at John Piper's church there, Bethlehem Baptist Church. And so I went through the apprenticeship and seminary there and then was kind of at the ground zero when that was becoming more than just an institute, but was a full degree granting, full college, full seminary. So I did that for about 18 years from about 2005 until a couple of months ago when we moved west. And I am now here in Moscow teaching at New St. Andrews and working at Christ Church.
Right on. So being from Texas and specifically Midland, you've got to be somewhat of a football fan.
I am. So I grew up playing West Texas high school football. So Friday Night Lights, like that was my high school. And so I did that all through high school and then kind of took a break. I mean, like I did like intramurals in college or whatever. But then when I started having kids, we were baseball family. So I got big baseball history. So we did baseball all through when we were in Minnesota. But then we moved out here. And so my boys started playing football. Like this is the first time they've played football. So I got a sixth grader playing football for a team. And then my ninth grader is on the place for Logos here, 8-man Idaho football. And we are in the state playoffs on Friday.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Perfect. Are you coaching, Joe, or are you?
I am. So I've coached baseball for years, but then came out here and was like, I want to just dive in with both feet. And so I'm an assistant coach, kind of helped out with the junior varsity team, which is what my son's ninth grade. So he was on that, but also helping out with the high school football team here. So I'm like the low man on the totem pole. I don't know. These guys definitely know football better than I do. And I'm just there to like hold the card to like show people what the thing is. But it's sure a lot of fun.
You know, as we talk about fatherhood, one of the things that I remember from growing up was sort of how sports were so formative So just talk about that experience. Why is it important as a family? You guys are obviously involved in that. But in the formation of your boys, how does that play out?
Yeah, I think I didn't recognize at the time how big of a deal it was. So I played baseball, soccer, you know, like I played all the sports when I was really young, and then got into like football beginning seventh grade, kind of kept baseball through like sophomore year, and then was like really just all in on football. And I don't think until I was, I don't know, like yesterday, realized how formative some of that stuff was. Really, a couple of things like the teamwork dimension of just like men doing things together and the sort of shared mission and the camaraderie that comes and that sense of brotherhood and accomplishment that comes when you do things together, hard things together. But I think that there was something there that was just sort of woven in. It's a natural good. It's not a spiritual good in and of itself, but it's a good thing that can be sort of taken up. And I don't think I realized how formative that was. And then I think just, yeah, the really doing the hard part of it. So, you know, you're doing 2-a-days. It's August. It's West Texas. It's 105. And it's just brutal. And you have to push your body through it. Or it's winter and you're not playing baseball or you're not playing football again for another like 9 months. And yet there you are like in the weight room and you're doing, I remember distinctly, like we would have these, I don't know, sequences of stuff where like different stations during the winter. And we would do like the monkey bar type thing and just go through and like have to like do the hand pops and stuff like that. And your hands would just be bloody. And it's like, it's January and you're not playing football again until August. And it's like, why are my hands are bleeding because I'm doing this. Why am I doing this? This is so. But it was like because you needed to have a certain mentality, you needed to have a certain fortitude. And so I don't think I appreciated that in sort of the philosophical step out of this and think what's good, what is this good for? But now I would say that was really that it sort of put something in the character that then I would say later has been sort of taken up natural good that sort of was elevated by grace to a spiritual good. And so then when I look at my boys, I'm like, that's what I want. So I've seen it kind of in baseball. My son, one of my sons is a pitcher. And so there's that moment when he's on the mound and like things aren't going right. Guy makes an error. And like just there's a mental thing that has to happen there of just like pushing through. And he needs to experience both the oh no and the disappointment as well as then all right, push through it. So I've seen that sort of in the mental side and though, you know, baseball is great for it's a team sport with the one-on-one dynamic, like it's pitcher versus batter and everything's on your shoulders and you're either going to get a hit or you're going to strike out or you're going to strike him out or he's going to get a hit. And so I love that aspect. And then adding football to it, I think now has really helped me to appreciate just that brotherhood of like you do it all together. Everybody has to be moving as a unit. Everybody's got their job. If one guy fails, the whole thing fails. And there's an element our head coach talks a lot about just the sacrifice that's required in a sport like football that you don't get credit for. So like the quarterback is going to be in the newspaper. You're the O-lineman and nobody cares.
You get no love.
But you get no love. You get no love. But like you're throwing your body on the line every time to help him get yards so your team can win. And nobody knows who you are. And so there's a kind of self-sacrifice and lose your life. And it's not going to be for your name's not going to be written in lights, but it's still what you're built for. You're built to die. You're built to lay yourself down for the good of the mission and the good of the team, which is, and our coach, this is one of the great things. When I was in high school, I did it at a public high school. So I went to public high school all the way through. And so all of that stuff, like it was West Texas, so it was Christian-y culture, but it was still very worldly. You know, all of the guys in the football team were professing Christians who would get, you know, they would let a lot of drinking and sleeping around and stuff like that. And the coaches sort of winked, laughed, encouraged a lot of that sort of stuff. Now I'm at a Christian school and it's like you get all the stuff and then it's been, you know, baptized. You know, like and now we're going to connect the dots for these guys of, you know how hard it was today. This is so that you can love your wife someday when it's hard, you can lay down your life. And so it's making the connections explicit, which has been really cool, honestly. Like, it's like, oh, it's all of the things that I loved about high school football, but now with Jesus, like in the middle of it. And boy, that's even better.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's phenomenal. You know, it reminds me like a lot of the conversation in reform circles, especially right now. Doug even wrote about this, right, with the first No Quarter November, about masculinity. I think there's a lot of people trying to work through that issue. There's pushback on both sides. You know, masculinity isn't just about being physically fit, although we would say, well, yeah, but where does it fit? So as you think about sons, especially in raising young men, how do you kind of work through those issues, both as a pastor and as a father?
Yeah. So I think, so like physical training is of some value. Like that's in the Bible. So you can't make it everything because it's not everything. It's of some value. And so that's where it belongs, is it's of some value, which can then, so don't make it a god, but don't treat it as a nothing, as though it doesn't matter. It does matter. Physical training is of some value. But training godliness is of ultimate value, right? That's Paul's point, is take the thing that's of some value, of natural value, and then use it to sort of better understand the spiritual dimensions of life. Like that's the thing that needs to govern it. So when I look at my sons, I can see areas in their life, you know, I want them to be motivated. I want them to take initiative. I want them to sacrifice. I want them to have fortitude. I don't want them to crumble. I don't want them to be passive. And so, and I can exhort them to all of those things in a spiritual sense. But where does the sort of intuitive knowledge of what that even means come from? So this is, I mean, this is at some level, it's like a things of earth point, right? So like I've got the things of earth stuff. And this is just an application of that, where it's like you, in the same way, the Bible says, eat honey because it's good. Drippings of the honeycomb are sweet to your taste. Know that wisdom is such to your soul. So I can't just say, hey, if I say just wisdom is good, you're like, okay, what does that mean? But if I'm like, wisdom is good the way that honey is good on your tongue, then you're like, oh, well, I know how honey is good on my tongue. And so you're saying wisdom is like that? And it's the connection between the sort of natural physical thing and then the elevation of that into the spiritual, into the soul level, that is how the Bible works. It's the same thing here. Like my boys need, they need the hardship of physical reality because God made us as physical beings. They need that. And then the goal is, hey, do you remember when, you know, your legs got taken out and it hurt and you wanted to come out of the game? And I said, no, you don't get to come out of the game. You have to laugh and keep playing, shake it off and go. And you did. Like you were limping and it hurt, but like you pushed through it. Okay. You're going to need that in all kinds of places spiritually in your life. You're going to get something's going to sweep you off your feet spiritually, right? Calamity's going to happen. And you don't have the luxury of saying, I'm going to take a time out now and tap out. It's like, you've got to get back on your feet because God has something for you to do. And so they need that lived experience basically in order to have categories to see, and this is how Paul does it, right? Like the run the race set before you, or the, you know, compete as though you want to win the prize. All of that imagery, Paul assumes that you know what races are, you know what boxing is, you know, you know these sports and you have some intuitive sense of them. And then that's going to give you categories for thinking about the Christian life.
Mm. Yeah, that's really helpful. And you mentioned your book, The Things of Earth. I did want to ask you about that. Was there something in life and study? What was going on that you said, hey, I think this is an issue. We need to address both the physical as well as the spiritual realities.
Kind of coming of age in early 2000s, young, restless, reformed, supremacy of God in all things. Like, you know, John Piper is one of the seminal influences in my life, you know, opened up a whole world of biblical reality, supremacy of God when I was in college. And yet, and then when I moved there, I wanted to see what that was like on the ground. And it was like, as I was living there, it was evident that that emphasis, which was really needed, also could create certain, it could go wrong in certain sorts of ways and in predictable ways. There was a kind of asceticism, which the Bible has a certain kind of asceticism, but it could kind of get twisted, you know, everything, good things can get twisted. And so it would get twisted. And so it was basically like, okay, Jesus is supreme. What does that mean for all this stuff though? Like, what do I do? Like, okay, Jesus is better. Now what do I do? And it was the now what do I do thing that I felt personally, as a young married guy, and then started kind of working through that. You know, Doug actually was really helpful in a lot of ways. It's kind of like the parent, like that book I've described as sort of like this, you know, union of three rivers. It's like Jonathan Edwards, John Piper, C.S. Lewis, and Doug Wilson, just kind of like, boom. And it's like, pull those together and that's, you get things of earth. That's me. And so it was like building out, how do I actually engage with created reality in a way that's faithful, that knows Jesus is better, but also doesn't despise it. Doesn't, can say thank you for it, can enjoy it rightly. And so that's where that book kind of came from. And then I think I've just, you know, over the years, it's just kind of like a deepening sense of like, yes. And there's ditches on every side. Like it's not like there's one way to like, okay, now we don't have to worry about any dangers, idolatry. You don't have to worry about that. Ingratitude. Like, no, you're always got to worry about all of it. But it's an attempt to kind of to get it right, to order it rightly.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I want to ask you about another book, which is More Than a Battle. You've probably seen this pastorally in other fields. It seems like one of the most common things, especially with men, but not exclusive to men, is the issue of pornography and lust. So you've written about this. Obviously, it's going to be crucial in sort of that fatherly training of sons. But why this book, and what is your approach, I guess, in it to wrestling with that issue and being a good discipler of young men?
Yeah, so I have history there when I was in high school and college, and the way that that sort of issue in a sort of the pre-smartphone era, but the internet era, was kind of a major stumbling block and a major sin area. And saw God do a great work in my life in, you know, in the beginnings of marriage and in beyond there to sort of see like, oh, change is really possible here. God, the gospel is really powerful against this issue. And yet it's not an automatic thing. It's not like you can just wave the gospel at your sin and it's not a magic word. It's not a talisman. It's not like, you know, you actually have to understand how sin works, how it corrupts, and what goods are underneath it that are getting twisted so that you can restore them rightly. And so you really got to get into the muck in order to, like, you got to scrub and you got to then know what the thing is that you're scrubbing. And so that was kind of where that book came from, was a recognition of like, I think sometimes sanctification for Christians in all areas is like, just preach the gospel to yourself. And it's like, well, okay, but how? Like, what does that actually mean? How does the gospel do something to this? And then the wisdom stuff of, it's not just, this is something that came later in the game for me, but was like a light bulb of just that in the scriptures, sanctification is both a matter of like sort of your mental life, mental, you know, the mind and the will level, but also the bodily level. Like they're both included. So you think about a passage like Romans 12, offer your bodies as living sacrifices, and then don't be conformed to the pattern of this world, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. So like there's this bodily thing, you're supposed to offer your body in a certain way, and there's this mental thing, you're supposed to be transformed by the renewal of your mind, and you need both. Or in Romans 6, where it's consider yourself dead to sin and alive to God in Christ. So in light of what Jesus has done, consider yourself, think of yourself in a particular way, or, you know, think about yourself in a particular way. And then the next passage is, don't present your members as instruments of unrighteousness. So there's that bodily thing again. And so I think it was both of those, recognizing like our bodies are can be shaped, they can be molded, they can be habituated. You can cut brain ruts, and that's what porn does. Not just porn, but like smartphones in general do this, right? Like they're designed as sort of these addictive deals. And so you're habituating yourself, you're cultivating habits, and therefore your body, when like with porn, your body is your enemy. You've weaponized your body against your soul, basically. And so that's not something that's going to be fixed with like a snap of a finger. Oh, you got converted. Didn't fix it right away. Like instead, what it did is sort of, there's this new principle, like new birth, new life at the core, but now it's got to work its way out, right? Work out your salvation, right? You've got to work it out. And that's something that takes intentional, wise effort, usually with community to help get eyes on it and to hold you accountable to it. And so that's kind of the approach of the book. The goal was, sanctification is a community project. It's not a solo deal. And if you try to fight that fight particularly solo, you're gonna lose badly. And so how do you cultivate groups of men who wisely, faithfully, are in each other's corner, right? Like I'm for you, God's for you. And in fact, I'm for you in the way God is for you, which means I'm not gonna leave you wallowing in this pit, but we're gonna try something different. And so what hands do we need to cut off? What eyes do we need to gouge out? Let's wage war. And then not just war, but thinking about like other, like the warfare imagery is helpful as one lens, I think, to view the fight with sin. But there's also this sort of like slavery element, like you're a slave to sin. So that's not just war. That's like, you need to be delivered. You need to be freed. And then there's this sort of brokenness element, which I think is a real one. Like, you know, you're broken, you're weak. You need to be healed. You need to be restored. And so it's like, okay, those are three different lenses, three different sort of metaphors or word pictures to think about the fight with sin or the struggle against sin. And I wanted to kind of bring all of them and say like, hey, there's certain things that probably need to get healed, certain fuel that's underneath this struggle. It's like lust is not just, for most guys, lust is not simply a matter of like physical release. Like there's that element that gets hijacked, but there's often a deeply emotional component to it. They're seeking something else. Like it's a pursuit of manliness. It's vicarious manliness. You're wanting to see your own sort of manhood reflected in the sexual satisfaction of a woman, but you're doing it on a screen or something like that. And so it's like, what are you actually looking for? It's not just sexual release. It's some sort of validation and approval. Well, that's interesting. Like so then where's that supposed to be met? And so you're just broadening it out. So that's the kind of things, broadening it out, deepening it, trying to figure out the subtleties. to where you're fighting at earlier stages. So that whole book is basically like a guide for men's groups, really, for both mentors and guys who are in the pit to like work together to like try different things in order to wisely apply the gospel and walk by the Spirit.
I guess I've got a question. I'm a father of four young boys. What would you say, you know, to a guy like me that has young boys, they don't have any exposure to the digital world, really? How do I best guard my sons against even being introduced to this world of pornography, and how do I insulate them?
Yeah. So I think there's the proactive thing you're doing is you're going to try to teach them self-control in other areas. So self-control is just, it's a habit. It's not something you can't just turn it on all of a sudden when porn shows up. So in other areas, so whether it's just their emotions and impulses in general, like, are they, you know, do they know, like, I have to talk to my kids, right? Like I've got three boys. I got 14, 12, and four. And especially with the older ones, it's like, you know, they're in that kind of junior high age and you're like, hey, okay, your passions are going, you're just kind of being crazy. Can you rein it in? Do you know where the line is? You know how to not to cross the line? I'm not saying don't have fun. I'm not saying don't be silly. I'm not saying don't have, you know, all that sort of stuff. But do you know where the lines are? And are you in control of you, or do your passions run the show? Like, are your impulses in charge? And so that's something that you can do from like, okay, are they two? you're like, okay, we're trying to help you with your, you know, control your passions. Because sexual lust is just one passion, right? So controlling passions, you know, whether it's anger, whether it's, you know, anxiety, worry, all of these things are passions. And so you're working on that. That's proactive all the way through. And you need to be thinking about it as I'm doing this partly so that when they hit 15, 16, they've got some ballast to be able to deal with the new challenge that the hormones just turned on. I think on the other side, and this is something I actually, where my wife, I think has been a real help to me in recognizing just like, so like these things right here, right? These are like, it's like having a brothel in your pocket. Okay. So like sexual sin's as old as dirt. It's always been there since, you know, early days. Lamech's got two wives, right? So Nephilim, whatever, you know, that, all that stuff. So all of that, it's old as dirt, and sexual immorality, fornication are all through. But like, you had brothels, but now you have a brothel in your pocket. And that sort of changes the game. And it means that, you know, it's in the old days, it's like, let's just make sure our kids don't go to that store or to go down that street or whatever. And now it's like they carry the street with them in their pocket. And so that requires a different level of diligence and vigilance in trying to guard them from things so they don't stumble into it. And I don't think that Christians really have fully reckoned with this, both on the porn side, but just the technology side in general. Like what are these devices? And what do they basically open our families up to? And so, and this is a place where I think it's not simply, it's a household thing at one level, but I think it's a broader Christian community thing. Cause it, at some level you can go like, okay, I'm going to guard my family. My kid's not going to have a smartphone until he's, you know, 18 years old. You know, we'll get the dumb phone if we need to get a hold of him whenever he's in high school. That's what we've got. We've got like one of these Gab phones, which is like, it talks and it texts and that's all you need. There's no, you know, none of the other junk. And so it's like, it's a phone. We can get a hold of him, but it's like, okay, so that's true of him, but it's not true of all of his friends. And so now you've got like, okay, so how do I guard against that? Well, that's a function of just like community and culture in a, you know, so they're like the shared customs of like, hey, we all do this. And it's necessary for that because your kid's going to come home and say, well, so-and-so has the phone. All of my friends have the phone. All of my friends have this. Why can't I? And there's a constant then drip, drip, drip of frustration on the part of your son who's like, all the other Christian kids have this and I don't. And so, which is sort of removed if it's like, well, some of the kids in your class do, but a lot of the kids don't. And here's why. We talk to our kids now at this point of like, there are things we don't want you to see. There are images. There's immodesty. They know what it is. We've talked about once they started getting older, there's a set of books, I forget what they're called, but like they're kind of age appropriate. How do you talk to kids about sex kind of books? And it's like when they're really young, it's like, you know, mommy and daddy's lay in bed together and then a baby comes, you know, it's like, it's real basic. And then you kind of, every book kind of like graduates up a little bit and it's more like, hey, this is how it works. This is the mechanics. It feels good. And so we've been doing that periodically, just kind of checking in, giving them some more info so that they hear it from us and not from somebody, you know, in the playground, you know, somebody in the baseball team, and that they have a context for like, hey, he said that, somebody said this, And now we're like, yeah, remember when we talked about that? Okay, he's just making jokes about it. And so you're kind of working with them all the way. And then there's a category for, okay, some people take off their clothes and have sex with each other, and other people watch it because it feels good. And this is not what God wants. This is not what God intends. That's for marriage. That's a good thing, but it belongs in God's boundaries. And we don't want you to see it before then. We don't want you to be a part of it before then. And it's a snare. And we, you know, I can say stuff like, guys, there's stuff that I saw when I was young that I can still remember. Like it gets locked in there. And my kids actually have categories for this because they've seen stuff like scary stuff, you know, like when they're little, they see a commercial for a horror movie and when they like it's burned into their mind. And so you can appeal to that and say, hey, you remember when you saw that and it really scared you? And like, you still think about it? No, like, yeah. It's like, okay, there's other things that are like that. And so mom and dad are trying to guard you from those because we love you. And so you need to trust us. So that's kind of how that's how we're talking about it. And yet mindful of the fact that like, this is the world we live in. I wish I could give, I saw somebody the other day in an article was like, I wish I could give my kids a world in which porn was not ubiquitous, but it's not in my power to give them that world. Instead, I have to guard against that world. And that's a harder thing, but it's a necessary, and it's where I think men, families together have to like kind of band together so that everybody's on the walls and not just I have to guard my little household by myself.
Our sponsor, Private Family Banking Partners, is on a mission to help Christians live out the Dominion mandate by making a stealth-like move away from the mainstream banks and into their own privatized banking system. This innovative system is designed to guarantee uninterrupted compound interest and tax-free growth without exposure to typical stock market risks. To join this growing community that is already building wealth into future generations and converting post-mill talk into post-mill action, contact Private Family Banking partner Chuck De Laurentiis at his email, chuck@privatefamilybanking.com. Again, that's chuck@privatefamilybanking.com. To set up an appointment and to receive a free copy of Chuck's new book, Protect Your Money Now, How to Build Multi-Generational Wealth Outside of Wall Street, and avoid the coming banking meltdown, go to the link in the show notes for more information.
As the saying goes, gold is the money of kings, silver is the money of gentlemen, but debt is the money of slaves. If you're tired of seeing your wealth sapped by the silent theft of inflation, consider adding gold to your financial plan. Gold and silver have been recognized as sound money and a store of wealth for centuries. Converting your savings into gold and silver will protect and preserve your wealth so that one day you'll be able to pass down a true inheritance to your children's children. That's where our friends at Alpine Gold Exchange come in, offering 0% buy-sell spread, gold leases with up to 3.5% annual return, paid in gold, by the way, and secure vaulting right here in Utah. Alpine Gold approaches every transaction with fairness, honesty, and respect, reflecting a strong Christian business ethic in all that they do. Head to ogden.gold today or tap the link in the description to sign up or schedule an appointment to speak with an Alpine Gold advisor today and see what would best serve your family. And just so you know, if you schedule a call, you'll be speaking with Jace, Ethan, or Stu, three members of Refuge Church right here in Ogden. Head to ogden.gold and check it out today.
Today's episode is sponsored by Premier Body Armor, your top choice for safeguarding your family. What sets them apart? Well, Premier isn't here to convince you to wear a plate carrier around town. Nope. They're focused on innovating armor right into your normal everyday life. Think bulletproof laptop case or lightweight armor insert that fits into your favorite bag and stops most handgun, shotgun, and even rifle ammunition. Unlike much of the tactical industry, choosing Premier Body Armor not only ensures that you're getting amazing armor, but you'll be doing business with a family-owned Christian company. Visit PremierBodyArmor.com today and use promo code KingsHall for 10% off your order today. Got questions? Reach out to customer service or send their president an email directly at alex@premierbodyarmor.com and you can speak to him yourself. Don't wait to invest your family's security, but reach out today to Premier Body Armor. Don't carry a bag? No worries. How about a moisture-wicking athletic t-shirt with minimalist and lightweight soft armor panels built in? Check the link in the show notes or visit PremierBodyArmor.com today.
You know, there's nothing quite like a great cup of coffee in the morning. Here at New Christendom Press, we've really been enjoying coffee from our friends at Squirrely Joe's Coffee, a family-owned coffee company from Illinois. Joe and his wife, Rachel, put a ton of effort into quality roasted beans and wholeheartedly support us in our vision to bring all of Christ to all of life. Yes, even to that cup of coffee that's in your hands. You can order your first batch of coffee from Squirrely Joe's by going to squirrelyjoes.com or by clicking the link in the show notes below. First-time customers will receive 20% off their first order, so be sure to head to their website. Again, that's Squirrely Joe's at squirrelyjoes.com. Let them help you in your mission while you help them in theirs. Caffeinating the modern Reformation.
Yeah, that's really, really helpful. One of the broader questions, you were talking about young, restless, and reformed. You mentioned that earlier. A lot of the things that seem like maybe we all wish would go away, like the Josh Harris situation, they seem to come back. You know, his wife, I think, was in the news and you know, deconstructing, usually tied to sexual sin. As you think about that movement, kind of, you know, spending a lot of your years growing up in it, we all kind of did a little bit. What do you look back on, especially with like the sexual issues, maybe identify as like some bad fruit? What was going on that produced, you know, as I look at it, young, restless, and reform, it seems like it kind of died and there was a lot of fallout. So as you look at that, what do you see as maybe some things that we could say, okay, we could learn from this and not repeat?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think a couple of things when I consider back again, that was my coming of age, was all through that deal. And I think there was so much good in it, but it's actually not all that different from like the Great Awakening. So Jonathan Edwards during the Great Awakening, right? He's one of my guys. So Great Awakening, here's this great work of God, Whitfield's preaching, all these guys are preaching, and like people's lives are being changed. And yet Edwards is like, and as soon as that happens, Satan's going to sow weed among the tares. This is just how it goes. Like there's going to be counterfeits. There's going to be fakes. There's going to be stuff that looks like the real deal, but it's not the real deal. And so he writes like Edwards literally writes multiple books about how do you tell the difference between a true work of God and sort of its counterfeit. What's a reliable sign of genuine religion, of true religion, and what's not? And there's lots of things that are not, that sort of it's not that they're not, that they're bad. So like a good example in Edwards is like, if you talk a lot about religion, about Christianity, he's like, that's not reliable. Like Pharisees do that. Hypocrites do that. But it's not that it's negative. It's just not, you can't trust it. And so I think in some ways what happened with Young, Restless, Reformed was like that sort of thing. And so there's all sorts of good happening. And then there's all the counterfeit. There's all the counterfeit stuff that comes with it. So I think a couple of things, the function of celebrity culture in pushing young guys to the foreground too early. So I think like when you think about Josh Harris, like, I mean, that's clearly an issue in play. This guy's, he's writing books at 17 about dating, you know? And it's like, and I think that there was sort of this, I think this has been an affliction of a certain kind of Christian groups. I think classical Christian education can sometimes fall into this, where it's like, hey, we're going to outdo the world. Like, look what our kids are going to be able to do. Like, we're going to get them there quicker, better, faster. And it's kind of like this valid, like, look what we did. And you start showing off the fruit when it's like still, it's not ripe yet. It's like the fruit that you want to see, as a dad, the fruit that you want to see is like, look at my 17-year-old, but it's like, you're 60. And it's like, look at my 45-year-old, you know, I guess that's not right numbers, whatever the numbers would be. Like, look at my 40-year-old son raising his own kids faithfully. Like, that's the fruit when you can really go, hey, look at it. Like, look what God did. As opposed to kind of like preemptively going like, hey, here he is at 12 and he can recite the catechism. And it's like, that's great, but it's still too early. And so I think that there was kind of a rush to like put some young guys out there too young. I think, you know, this is what's going on with Driscoll at some level. Like he's 26, plants a church, it blows up. And then like, he's just kind of thrust out there and kind of is willing to roll with it. And so I think a lot, like there was a lot of that basically in that movement. And I think the healthier versions of it typically were those that emerged under the leadership of godly older men. Does that make sense? So like, I feel really like blessed. It was a great kindness that like in my zeal, it wasn't like, I'm going to go run out. I had this impulse. Like, I guess I'll go plant a church at 25, like Mark Driscoll did. Cause I read him in college. I was like, let's go do that. And instead it was like, no, I'm going to go to Bethlehem and like learn how to do it. And then therefore that was kind of like there was wise old hands, you know, kind of helping to guide and lead and temper and direct. And I think that was a great protection. It meant when I ran into stuff or things happened, there was people with some ballast that I could look to, like John Piper and the other elders at Bethlehem. And so I think that was like a, so one thing would be don't promote guys too young. That's like a biblical principle. Like don't, if young convert, it's not just young convert, it's just young immature guys in general shouldn't be necessarily put forward preemptively. And I feel some of that because I like wrote my first book at 30 and I'm kind of like, oh, like, was that okay? And it's like, it was at some level because there was other people's hands on the steering wheel a little bit. So that's one thing. I think the other thing to learn from is part of why I think the movement cracked up was because the theological center, like we're going to have theological unity, but we're not necessarily going to insist on other kinds of commonality. Like diversity was our strength, right? Like, and at some level, I like there's a good impulse there of like, hey, the big battles are not over Baptist, Pado Baptist, or even like charismatic cessationist. Like we can together for the gospel across that line. Like, but let's hold firm on sovereignty of God, complementarity, biblical authority. That's the core, and we have this diversity. And I think that's actually right. I think that's healthy. Mere Protestantism, mere Christendom sort of mentality. But what I think was missed is as the culture sort of went off the rails over, you know, beginning, you know, in the run up to Obergefell and then now over the last decade, I think what was missed is now we have to have a certain kind of posture. Like, how do we relate to this thing? And like, how do we respond to it actually didn't matter. And it was, that's a culture question. And so some of the crack up was people who could sign the same affirmation of faith, but their orientation towards the present moment was fundamentally different. And therefore different ministry philosophies. And then that's where you see kind of the parting of the ways. And so I think that one of the things that you're seeing right now is actually folks who have a shared theology, but also like a shared approach to cultural stuff, both internal culture building and external culture warring or not culture warring, whatever you want to call that other view. Like those people are finding each other and going like, yeah, we want to build together. And it's really hard to build if we don't have a shared mentality on culture building and culture warring. You can't build well.
Yeah, such a good point. You mentioned John Piper. I remember being in college reading Desiring God. And I think one of the best things it did for me, and John was just huge on this, was he was an introduction. He was like a gateway drug to all these great thinkers of the past, right? So we started, you know, here at New Christendom Press, we were going through old literature, old books, especially with the school, too. Our kids are reading them. And they're like, Dad, you haven't read the Song of Roland. What's wrong with you? You need to read this book. So it's interesting, the more we've gone back and looked at stuff, you can sort of trace, you know, the history of revivals and reformations throughout, you know, the last couple thousand years. And it always seems to be tied to education. You know, Alfred the Great maybe being a good example where it's like, yeah, he defeated the Danes. That's definitely true. But he was also leading his people in learning how to read and, you know, translating the Bible into the vernacular and stuff like this. So I want to ask you, why, as we think about, you know, Reformation, wanting to see great works of God in our culture, in our day, in the church and society, why is it so important to tackle and deal well with this issue of education?
I think the way I approach this question is like, if you think of the church and or the people of God, so don't think when I say people say church and they immediately think of like just the institution of the church or something like that. So think people of God in all of its facets. The heart, it's a body. The heartbeat of that body is worship. Okay. So that's one of the things we emphasize out here in Moscow. So one of Doug's long-term standing is like worship is like the foundation. It's the heartbeat. It pumps blood to everything else. Okay. I think education is like the backbone. It's the skeleton of the body. So you need a heart to pump blood. Like if you take out the heart, that body's going to die. It's not going to make it, right? You got to have the heart beating, pumping the blood. But then you also have to have that skeleton. Otherwise it's just a, you know, blob. It doesn't act, it can't actually do thing. And so the teaching ministry of the church, so teaching and preaching in the church, but also this sort of educational thing, Christian education, the paideia of God, that's the backbone. And then it's when you have the heartbeat in the backbone, and then you start putting flesh on it, which is when you get into like Christian vocation, like vocation and mission and all of the other elements of body life, thick community. All of that is like flesh, but it's like built on this foundation of, you know, worship and education. So it is really important. And I do think that that's one of the, you know, people can say Young, Restless, and Reformed kind of like has dwindled. But I think what it did exactly what you said is it introduced a whole generation of people to like the riches of our tradition, which had sort of been neglected, lost. And all of a sudden guys are like reading these books. And I think actually some of what's happening right now in the present divisions among Christians that kind of all came from that movement, the young, that sort of stream, is a bunch of guys kept reading. Right. So it's like, you know, it was like, hey, let's go read the Puritans. Hey, let's go read the Reformers. Hey, let's go read these guys. And we're reading them on, you know, doctrine of God and sanctification and the gospel. And we're like, man, this is great stuff. And then some guys are like, hey, have you read them on political philosophy? You know, and other people are like, no, don't do that. Right. like start out that they got that wrong. And so that the debate is like, are they helpful? How helpful are they? And how all of their stuff, some of their stuff, where did they get it wrong? Where did they get it right? And the debates are, some guys kept reading and were like, this makes sense too. And then other guys were like, no, that's not it. And so that's, but it was the introduction to that great tradition of Christian reflection that was, I think, will be one of the great legacies of that kind of resurgent Calvinism, is that it introduced us to a rich tradition, which we can then sort of revitalize and apply in our own day.
Yeah, really helpful. One of the questions I want to ask you, I saw this on Twitter. Somebody had asked you, or I think they said something like, you know, I'm coming out and I'm just going to say that Tolkien is better than Lewis. Yeah. And so we, you know, we had some division in the office. There's a little bit of division, I would say. But yeah, we were discussing this. And, you know, one of the things that came to mind was these guys were both great. You mentioned that you quoted G.K. Yeah. Chesterton. Yeah. But as you think of both of them, we've sort of talked about them as, I think in 1,000 years, people will read Tolkien and be like, great, still great. They'll read Lewis and they'll say, still great. What is it about these guys, particularly their education, what they were reading, that made them the titans of literature that they were, among other things?
Right. Yeah. So I don't think people fully appreciate how many great books those guys had to read in order to produce what they produced. Right. It didn't just fall out of the sky. It wasn't, and it wasn't just, oh, Lewis is really smart, Tolkien is really smart. It's like, no, they were very bookish, and they lived at a time when education was what it was. And so they're reading these texts and they're soaking in them, and it's just marinating. You know, Tolkien talks about like it bubbles up from the leaf mold of the mind. And so it's just like all of this stuff is just churning under the surface, so that when it comes time for them to write, it's like they're channeling all of the things that they've digested. They've eaten the tradition, like they've eaten it, digested it. It's a part of them. And then now they're able to kind of speak. And so they speak with the wealth of the ages, the wealth of the, you know, and so that's their real, that's the secret sauce. And there's no shortcuts. You cannot shortcut that and just try to get it on the cheap, which is, I think, the modern temptation is to say, oh, yeah, we've got, look at all the technology. We can get from here to there really fast. Like, yeah, you can't short circuit wisdom. You can't short circuit that kind of imagination and creativity. And so you're right to say, I think we'll be reading those guys for centuries, and people will look like, when there's always like, you know, when we look back at the past, it's like there's certain thinkers that are like that century's thinker, or like that, you know, like there's a few guys. It's like, oh, you know, Aquinas is like 13th century, and like Anselm's like, you know, 1000 to 1100, and Augustine's like, you know, when he is. So it's like there's like these guys, and it's like Tolkien and Lewis, I think, will be those kind of thinkers for the 20th century.
Oh, yeah. I'm just curious, like, what would you identify as sort of the core influences of stuff they were reading? I know particularly like medieval literature. These guys are steeped in it, but, you know, Lewis or Tolkien, what do you see as like the really dominant works that affected them?
Yeah. So I think I know Lewis better than I know Tolkien, because Tolkien was reading like other like weird stuff. Like, he's in like Norse mythology, yeah. Like he's into all that. And I'm like, I don't even know what that is, if that's a thing. And I'm sure he read the mainstream stuff too, but, you know, the Anglo-Saxon Beowulf, you know, that kind of thing. But with Lewis, it was definitely, you know, Dante. So like Great Divorce is just Dante's Divine Comedy updated for the 20th century. Like, it's the same story. Okay. And there's in Virgil, the Aeneid's in there, and the Aeneid's, you know, so Lewis loved the Aeneid, like wrote a started writing a translation of it, and he loved Dante. And so then he does his own little journey to the afterlife thing. And it's basically George MacDonald is his Virgil. And this is just, it's the same thing. It's just, he's updated, he's internalized it. And so that's what it is. The space trilogy, Perelandra, is Paradise Lost. It's the Paradise Lost, but it's not actually lost. Like, Ransom's there to save the day. And so, but if you read, for example, Lewis wrote a book called The Preface to Paradise Lost, And it was, that was written at the same time he was writing Perelandra. And you can just see like, oh, he's just doing it. If you read Milton, you read that. So I think that there's that sort of dimension of his. So Virgil, Dante, Milton. And then I think like the romantic poets, I think that's another big kind of influence on him is he read the romantics and there was the, and it called him out of himself. It was where some of the, you know, Wordsworth and these guys were some of the places where the light from beyond the sun, the longing for joy and this ache for something greater like that. It touched him there, even though they weren't necessarily Christians, they were getting at something. And he kind of wanted to follow. Where'd that come from? I want to go find where that came from. And so then he's chasing that back and he eventually finds it, you know, in Christianity as sort of the thing that reconciles his imagination, which was stoked by that, and his reason, which up until that point had sort of said, well, it's all materialism. It's all atheism. And he couldn't bridge the gap. And it was like Christianity was like, no, they can. They come together. So I think those would be some of the influences. I also think if you read his letters, like guy's just reading novels all the stinking time. Like he's reading like Jane Austen. He's reading Shakespeare. Like I think Shakespeare's a big influence in like Narnia and places like that. The whole, you know, my whole deal on manhood, right, comes from King Loon in Narnia. This is what it means to be a king, to be first in every desperate attack, to be last in every desperate retreat. And when there's hunger in the land, as must be now and again in bad years, to wear finer clothes, laugh louder at a scantier meal than any man in your land. That little speech, first in, last out, laughing loudest, is basic. It's basically a summary of Henry V, Shakespeare's Henry V. So like Henry V is like the, before there was Braveheart, you know, before there was Gladiator, there was Henry V, you know, once more under the breach, right? Henry's like the one leading them into the battle. They're surrounded and he's like going through the camp. And it's the Shakespeare talks about how he's like encouraging his men. He's like the sun giving him a little touch of Harry in the night. Like he's bucking them up when everything's dark. Well, that's laugh louder at a scantier meal. So like all of that stuff, like he's channeling Shakespeare in Henry V in that story. And so I think that again, he's just soaked himself in all this great literature. And so it's at his fingertips whenever he gets creative.
Yeah, that's so great. One of the things we've talked about with Fatherhood this season, the King's Hall podcast, is the need to tell the right stories to our children. Brian was mentioning like with Eustace Scrubb, like he heard all the wrong stories. They were talking to him about drains and engineering probably and stuff like that. As you think about that, and particularly the Chronicles of Narnia, a lot of people said, oh, this is a child's story. And then I read as an adult and I weep and I, you know, am moved by the story. But why this story? Why do you think this story is so important? Why is it important that, you know, you look around Christian communities and like most parents are like reading this or kids or the kids are reading it. But why is Narnia so important?
Yeah, I think because it does two things. It taps in both to kind of the Christian, there's the Christian elements to it, death, resurrection, sacrifice, all of that sort of stuff. So there's all sorts of Christian themes that are there. But I think also like the medieval stuff, the weaving together of the medieval cosmos and mindset and approach. And I think that I honestly think that some of it is he put it in a fairy tale. So, and when he talks about fairy tale, it's like it what it provided for him was certain kind of constraints. It meant he couldn't do, there was not going to be a love story because, you know, like in other words, it wasn't going to be, there's no way to do junior high or not junior high, like high school, young adult fiction.
It's not Twilight.
It can't be that. It's not Twilight. It's exactly right.
And thank God.
yeah, because, and so it's got to be pitched at this level of you can still have go win the princess. Right. All of that stuff can show up, but it has to be done in the fairy tale mode, which is very different than the angsty teen drama mode. And so I think that provides certain kind of guardrails for him to work within. So the form suited it well. And then he had both the Christian stuff and the medieval stuff at his fingertips to tell this story, to really. And then I think to follow it through and go like, this is the argument of Michael Ward and his stuff on Planet Narnia. Is basically he had certain kind of qualities that the medieval mind associated with the planets, and he wanted to like capture them in a story, like weave it into a story. And he did really effectively. And so I think that's part of why, I think that's just why they work, is that he's tapping into something perennial, they're permanent value to these themes. And he was qualified to be able to weave them in. And what's funny is this is the Tolkien thing. Like Tolkien did not like it. Because he was like, you're not allowed to mix those. And Lewis is like, but watch me. I'm going to do it anyway.
I'm still doing the thing.
I'm still doing it. Yeah. You know, you cannot put you know, children, the witch from Hans Christian Andersen and the children out of E. Nesbitt with a lion and a fawn, you know, and then Father Christmas, for goodness sake, like you can't mix those together. And Lewis is like, but I can actually, I really will. And there's a unity to that, like this jovial, always winter, never Christmas, giving way to spring and new life. Like that idea, he's like, that's the thing that's going to, you know, pull all this together. And he's going to do something similar with martial virtue and hardiness and doing hard things. He's going to do the same thing in Prince Caspian, oldness, woods, all of these things. Like there's a center. He's going to like pull it all together. And Tolkien didn't see it. That's what's funny. It's like Tolkien was such a detail oriented guy that he could not get past the hodgepodge. And I think Lewis just thought that was probably the funniest thing ever.
Yes. So I know there have been some polls on Twitter in the past about favorite characters in the Book of Narnia. I have a strong opinion about that. I was curious. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I was curious. What about you? King Loon obviously seems like a top tier.
Exactly. So, like, I would say, classic answer there for me is Loon. Minor character, but he's got that speech and he embodies it well. Like, he lives it out. He's a model. Outside of that, it's Puddleglum.
Puddleglum.
What were you going to say? What were you going to say?
Puddleglum.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you're going for a Reef Cheap, but.
Oh, Reap a Cheap. Oh,
I mean,
man.
That's my guy.
No, still Puddleglum. Because my demeanor kind of matches. I can relate to him. So,
yeah. So I've got one of the next projects at some point, whenever I catch a minute, is working on something with like Puddleglum's faith.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And because I think, you know, I've done some lectures before at Bethlehem on basically the silver chair. That's that scene in the silver chair at the end when they're underground and the witch comes in and the harp and the conversation there. I think it's probably one of the most profound analyses and diagnosis of modernity and like the dark enchantment of the modern world, like ever. Like it's like he just pegs so much and packs so much into that, like the perceptiveness of like what's actually going on. And then like the antidote to it, like Puddleglum's sticking his foot in the fire and then answering the witch's, I'm going to live like a Narnian, even if there's no Narnia speech, is I just think that's like this really tightly packed analysis and diagnosis and cure for the dark enchantment of modernity. And so like I'm probably going to build that out at some point, because I do think that that's it's needed. It's just like this is the world we live in, and we do have this like dark enchantment thing. Like this is what Lewis is so brilliant at, is that a lot of thinkers have talked about the disenchantment of modernity, right? Like the world used to be enchanted. We believed in fairies. We believed in supernatural beings. We lived in angels and demons and God. And it was all, we lived in an enchanted world. And then like the Enlightenment came along and then modern technology, and they crushed it. And now the world's disenchanted. And Lewis is like, actually, it's the modern world that is enchanted. The modern world is under a dark enchantment. So he flips it on his head. It's not that it's been disenchanted. It's that you're right now, this minute, under a dark enchantment. You've fallen asleep. You've been listening to the witch. She's been playing her music. There's something in the air. Like it smells bad. It makes you drowsy. It numbs you to sleep. That's the enchantment. It's not that it was enchanted and now it's not. It's that before you were sober-minded and the world was just magic because the world's magic. And now you've been put under an enchantment. And so you don't recognize it as such. And just flipping that on the world on is like, whoa, okay, wow. What implications does that have for how I think about reality? Is it naturally a disenchanted world that we need to add some special magic to in order to like, hey, let's enchant it, everybody. Let's re-enchant the world. Or is it like, freaking wake up. You know, like you're under a spell. Like, and Lewis talks about this in other places in his Weight of Glory. He talks about this where he says, you know, he's sort of talking about this longing that we all have for something more, and the like hunger and the that kind of romantic impulse. And he's like, do you think I'm trying to weave a spell? And you're like, maybe I am. But remember your fairy tales. Spells are useful for breaking enchantments as well as for inducing them. And we have need of the strongest enchantment to break the dark spell of modernity that all of our education has been inculcating in us for the last 100 years. He's like, we are all under an enchantment and I am trying to wake you up.
Oh man, that's so good.
Can we call dibs on that book?
Yeah, dibs. Dibs. We heard it first, hopefully. Yeah. Dude, that's great. Yeah, no, phenomenal. Speaking of dark enchantment, some people have been talking about a dark alchemy brewing.
Yeah, I don't know actually what this is. What is this? So like I see tweets and they're like dark alchemy, and I'm like, I don't know what that is.
Yeah, so it was basically Owen Strand was talking about all these, well, it followed the adoption tweet by I don't know who did that, but there are people who are, I think they call them Christian nationalists, And so I think Owen is kind of responding to that. And but it gets back to something I think that you're talking about earlier, which was really a division, I think, even between the reformers on sort of the magisterial side versus radical, you know, Reformation guys like myself. You know, we've been reading things that Canon puts out, like Stephen Wolfe, and we're reading about what did some of our fathers in the faith think about classical two kingdoms, et cetera. And then you've got another camp that's saying, no, this is dark magic. We don't need to read about this. This is bad juju. And one of the questions I was going to ask you is, I know that at some point, I think on Twitter, you had offered like, hey, I'll step in a debate, help foster this to happen. But first of all, why do you think this issue, I've often asked this, why this issue among all issues, why is this so important right now? Why are so many people talking about it and getting kind of heated at points?
Yeah. So I think Aaron Wren, his three worlds thing is a helpful device for understanding what's happening. And so the move from positive, from Christendom conditions with positive world. So if you think of like Christendom is like when the prodigal son, he's at home and then he goes, he says, "Take, give me the money." And he goes, and that's like neutral world where he's like spending the money on the hookers and everything's okay. And then at some point he runs out of money and it's like, okay, now we're in negative world. Like you ran out of money and you're in the pigsty. And so, but the thing about negative world that I think is the thing that has to be underscored is what it's a fundamentally a rejection of is Christian ethics. And Christian ethics are just universal ethics. It's not, there's nothing, the whole point of biblical law is not that it's like this special law imposed on reality, but it's just like natural law. Like it's like the God baked these standards into the cake. And it's the rejection of the ethics that's different. So like Thomas Jefferson wanted to like cut up his Bible. He had scissors. Jefferson's Bible was with Jefferson's scissors, but he wanted to cut out all of the peculiar doctrines, all of the miracle stuff, deity of Christ and the cross and the resurrection. He wanted all that, but he wanted to keep the ethical. Okay. Modern Thomas Jeffersons want to cut out all the ethical, right? They don't actually don't mind the miracles. They could maybe the world's, haunted cosmos, right? Like the world's spooky. They're fine with spooky mediums and necromancy and all this sort of stuff. That's all fine. Yes, that's miracles. That's supernatural. Maybe that's true. But all the ethics stuff, that's the parts that we got to cut out, especially the sexual ethics. And so that shift to negative world really marked, I think, a turning point. And what we're seeing then in the Christian response is, well, what do we do in light of it? And some people are like, well, what did our fathers in the faith do? How did they build Christendom? And was it good that they did it? And then I think part of what's happening with a lot of it makes sense that it's among Baptists that some of the pushback to the recovery of Christendom or the recovery of a Christian nation or that sort of thing is coming from Baptists. But it's because I think Baptist political philosophy was birthed in Christendom. All of them, these were birthed in Christendom, but Baptist was like the dissidents and the separatists within Christendom. And so there's a way in which Baptist political philosophy, I think, assumes Christendom conditions. It implicitly relies on it for a lot. And I don't think it's recognized how much it relies on Christendom for it to work, because it assumes that the moral, the ethical teaching and instruction, sort of the first and second uses of the law are present and active. And then Baptists come along and are like, yeah, and you really need to believe the gospel before you're baptized. Like, it's not enough to just be born in a Christian nation. You have to actually believe the thing. And which is that's a good exhortation. That's a danger of Christendom, is that you just coast. And so what happens then when you take away those background conditions, when those cultural conditions in the background that were sort of reinforcing, biblical morality, that were giving the law, when those are just removed, I think that Baptists have a hard time. And I think that that's why. And so then when you say, there's some foundation. It's going to be something. It's either going to be God or it's Christ or chaos. You can't hang horizontal earthly justice, man to man, no murder, no killing, no adultery. You can't hang that in midair. It needs to stand on something, and it stands on the confession of the living God of the first table. The second table of law depends on the first table of law, basically. And Baptists are really reluctant, but it's like I think they've been relying on that for it to make sense. And so that's where a lot of this discrepancy comes from, is Christendom is sort of in shambles. Even more so, especially the moral stuff. And so now there's some Baptists, I think, who are like, well, what do we do? And they're kind of like, oh, is there a way to do Baptist Christian nationalism, Baptist mere Christendom? And the other guys are like, absolutely not. And that's where that debate's coming from.
Yeah. What do you see as the way forward on that? I know obviously it's been fairly divisive at points. I personally would love to see, I think, a lot of good brothers just come together and have a discussion and maybe hash some things out. Maybe Constantine needs to hold a council for the church system. We don't have one of those. What do you see as the way forward?
I mean, I do think at some point, I'm encouraged that there's are at least good places where folks are really trying to have it. So like the Christ Overall, you guys know those guys, Christ Overall, they're a bunch of Baptists. So like SBC guys, by and large, but they through October, I think in November, they've been hosting like basically a bunch of podcasts interviewing different people. And the thing I've been impressed with them about is that they've been able to get folks from across the spectrum, not just their camp. So they got everybody from like a Jonathan Lehman and an Andrew Walker on the Baptist sort of side. And then they interviewed Stephen Wolf and Doug and Timon Klein on the other side. And so like they're pulling different guys, asking them same questions like, hey, what is this? What are the differences? And I think that, that's a really healthy thing. I think the thing that people that won't work is just trying to say, don't read that. Don't go there. This, you can't, it doesn't work. That kind of pressure, you have to win the argument. You can't just exert sort of the pressure and say, no, but it's really bad. You're going to have to actually have the debate, and suppression is just going to make it get worse. It's just going to make it, people more curious. Like, well, why can't I read it? I'm hopeful, you know, like we're, you know, one of the nice things about being out here has been like this, just willingness to kind of go anywhere and talk to anybody, and have the discussion. We're happy to have folks come out here. And I think I'm hoping at some point that more people will take us up on that and we'll be able to the first step is just clarity. Like what actually is the differences? Right. So like, I hate confusion. I just hate it. Like few things just get under my skin as much as like, but that's not what that guy thinks. And it doesn't matter. I think that guy's totally wrong. I think he's way out to lunch, but I'm like, that's not what he thinks. He thinks this and say it the right way. And then it's bring the clarity. It's either this or that. And then leave it in people's hands. Like you've got a Bible. It's either this or that. And I'm content to leave it there and just let it go. But oftentimes people are like, well, we're going to straw man this so that you hold on to what we think. And if you do that, if you straw man, eventually you burn your credibility because people are going to go read the thing. They're going to go read the source. And you told them that guy believed X and he doesn't. And now you've just burned your credibility. So don't, like, there's a lot of dangers in that, I think, for a lot of pastors who are just trying to tamp it down. As opposed to like honestly, forthrightly engaging, representing brothers fairly, getting it clear, and then saying, and this is why we disagree, this is why we agree, you got to make the call.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. Just curious, where do you fall, Joe, on the spectrum? I don't know if you're theonomistic, if you're...
Yeah, I'm classic Protestant. So people are going to call me a theonomist just because that's, you know, it kind of covers everything, but I'm not Vantillian. Like I appreciate stuff about Vantil, but I'm not a Vantillian. I've never read any of the Reconstructionists at all. And so I have nothing there. So it's like Calvin, Althusius, Hooker, classic Protestant, magisterial, all of that stuff. That's where I land with appreciation for the theonomists. But like, so the general equity theonomy, I think is just a way of, that's the way that guys around here will talk. I think that's just a way of talking about classic Westminster style. And the funny thing is, I just taught about this on Monday in our freshman theology class on the law. And on the question of like what aspects of the law still apply, there isn't a dime's bit of difference between the London Baptist Confession and the Westminster Confession. Like they're identical on this point. And so, you know, it's the moral law, it's the natural law summarized in the Ten Commandments, but like, it's not the, you know, so like there, this is actually a place where, hey, we should all be friends. We all agree on this. This is not like we disagree on other stuff, like, but we don't disagree on this. So there's the possibility of coming together to kind of get that, but that's where I'm at.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Joe Rigney, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of the podcast. It's been a pleasure and hopefully we'll get to do it again.
Yeah. Appreciate it, guys. Thanks.
Awesome. Thank you.